This is Alan Wright, recorded at the Marguerite Bay Reunion in Bowness on Windermere on the 30th of October 2010 by Chris Eldon Lee. Alan Wright.
Alan Wright. Alan Frederick Wright. Date of birth 12th of August 1934. Place of birth the house I'm living in now, Birmingham.
Whereabouts in Birmingham?
Quinton.
Okay. So now you're 70?
Six.
76?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, last August.
And you were wintering in Antarctic at Adelaide Island in 61 and 62?
Yes, that's correct.
And it says here you were a surveyor?
Yes, yes. I wasn't to start with.
You were a surveyor before you went?
No, no. In fact, I didn't know anything about FIDS before I went. Most people that are at university with geography, they know about it. I didn't, because I was mechanical engineering.
So what happened? How did you get to hear about it?
Well, I've always been fascinated by Scott. And in the Scouts, I was in the Scott Patrol, the seniors. And I eventually, I read a lot of the books as well, Cherry Apsley-Garrard, The Worst Journey in the World, and that inspired me quite a bit. And I decided, I was working on jet engine, rocket motor, research, experimental.
Is this with Armstrong Siddeley?
Yes.
Yeah.
At Coventry. And I decided it was fascinating work, but if I got this hankering to go to the Antarctic, I'd better do something about it rather than wish I'd done something about it.
And that hankering came from reading about Scott as a younger man?
No, just... Oh, as I was a younger man, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Yes. And I always enjoyed the snow. Just a general fascination with it. And so I thought, I'd better do something about it. And I hadn't got a clue what to do about it. But I guessed they must advertise. And I guessed maybe they advertise in the Times. And so the next morning I started buying the Times. And that was a Thursday. Second day, on the Friday, there was the advert. It's incredible.
For what, though? What were the adverts?
They were looking for a GA, general assistant. So I applied. I think I was so stunned to see the advert, I hesitated for a week. I thought, am I going to do this? And that's the decision. So I said yes, applied. But they wrote back saying, sorry, position has been filled already, but apply next year if you're interested. And the next year, in fact, well, that winter, I decided I'd better find out if I really do like skiing and that. So I went up to Scotland. In those days, there were no ski lifts. You had a walk up, which was great, because if you were tired, you didn't walk up again. So you never skied when you were tired. And they wrote to me, Bass, or FIDS as it was then, wrote to me asking me if I'd like to be considered as a meteorologist. Well, I'd always enjoyed MET work, so I said yes, went for the interview, and they said, we'll let you know. Then they sent me a telegram, would I like to be considered as a surveyor? So that was even better for me, because a surveyor was on a mobile network, whereas a MET man was on a fixed base. So I said yes, I went for the interview, it went great, until six questions came, and each question I had to say no, I don't know. What's spherical trig? Have you done any of this? No, no, no.
Well, they were interviewing you for a job about which you knew very little, I would have thought.
Correct, yes. Before I went to the interview, a friend of mine that I was at school with was on the civil engineering staff at Birmingham University, so I contacted him. And he showed me what a theodolite was, because I didn't know. I thought, I ought to know what this is before I went. And he showed me what a level was and showed me a few things.
So you did some homework?
Yes. Oh, yes.
But not enough, by the sound of things.
Not enough. Not on the mathematical side. So these six questions, I'm thinking, oh. So I went. They said, well, would you wait outside a bit? So I went out, and there was a very elderly... That's me now, 76, saying elderly. He was an elderly, bent-backed civil servant. And he said, how do you get on? I said, oh, not very well. And he said, did they ask you to wait? I said, yes. He said, you're all right. And sure enough, they called me back in. And they said, now, you know you've got the job as meteorologist. I said, no. Oh, didn't we tell you? They said, well, no problem. it's your choice. We'd like you to offer you the job as surveyor, but if you prefer the job as meteorologist, no problem. We don't mind. So I opted for surveyor.
Because you'd be able to do some sledging work.
Yes, much more interesting.
Who were they? Who was the other side of the table?
Now, I think it was... It may have been Bill Sloman, and also, I think, the Director of Overseas Surveys was there, Wiggins, I think that was at the time. So I think they asked me to leave, and Bill Sloman probably decided whether I was right calibre, and the DOS director probably decided whether they could hammer the maths into me.
Mm. Did you get any sense that you were being sussed out psychologically for this?
I didn't.
No.
But in fact, I think they certainly were.
Mm.
And I think they did a very good job. Basically, most of the FIDs, you didn't get many problems. And on our base, there were six of us, we had zero problems. So I'm sure they did.
So you knew, because they'd asked you questions you couldn't answer, you knew what you didn't know.
Yes.
So did you have to try and find out about that before you went?
I didn't have to try and find out about it. They said, look, don't worry, we can train you. They trained us.
They sent you away, did they, to train?
Yes and no. Away from home, but we went to the Directorate of Overseas Surveys, which was at Tolworth. South of London, and whilst there we also went to Imperial College for a week, Sunningdale, on a field course to learn how to observe astro work to the stars and the sun and the moon. And at DOS there was a chap called Norman Leppard, and he put us through a training course. There were three of us. Tony Edwards, who went to Hope Bay, Bob Metcalf went to Stonington, and myself to Adelaide. We didn't know where we were going until the end, and Norman sussed out which base he thought each of us would fit into better. And I think, again, he was very good.
Right.
He sussed, yes, yeah. Yeah. The brilliant thing about Adelaide that first year, they got six of us, and they got two Allens, two Gordons, and two Franks.
So you were training. How did you take to surveying work? Because it was new to you, wasn't it?
Oh, it's lovely, yes. No, it was the right element for me. It really was. The engineering was... I enjoyed it because it was leading-edge technology, and we went up in aircraft flight testing the engines, and we went in the test cells testing the engines. So it was really enjoyable. And I had reached a position whereby... I was in charge of defect investigation on a particular engine.
Mm-hmm.
But it was variety, but I wanted to get out. And
you wanted adventure.
Yes.
Adventure.
Yes.
You're perhaps not the right person to ask, but why didn't they just simply employ a surveyor rather than convert an engineer into one?
I don't know.
Mm.
I really don't know. possibly having... interviewed me as a meteorologist. They probably, when I applied as a general assistant, they probably looked at my CV and decided, well, I'd got a bit of background that might enable me to be trained as that. And then maybe when they suddenly wanted a surveyor, I don't really know.
Did you get the sense that there wasn't much competition, that there weren't hundreds of people knocking on the door wanting jobs?
Yes.
It was a...
I didn't form any idea whether there were a lot or not a lot. So no, when I said yes, then that's probably a wrong answer. I didn't form any impression about it.
Okay.
I was glad I'd found out where they were and had the interview, not really thinking, oh, I'm going to get this. Hoping I would, but not really having... strong feelings either way.
So you did your training, and then departure time came round.
Yes, and during the training, always the surveyors had a trip up to the geology department in Birmingham. Well, that was great for me because I lived in Birmingham. And we met Ray Ady, who was the professor there. And during this time, he was always very friendly to surveyors. A lot of the geologists, I believe, didn't get on too well with him at times because he was very demanding. But the surveyors, he was very friendly with. And when he found that I lived in Birmingham, he asked if I knew when I was going down, and I did. It was November the 1st or something like that, on the Biscoe. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And he said, oh, well, I'll take you down. And he arranged for his lab assistant to call at my house the day before to pick up my luggage and to call at my house on the morning to take me on the back of his motorbike to Ray Ady's house. And I went down in the car with Ray Ady. And that was a lovely welcome, really.
What kind of sailor were you?
Not very good. always remember, we sailed about 6 o'clock, I think. I said November the 1st. I don't know whether it was, but whatever it was. We sailed
around there.
Yes, we sailed down to Solent.
On which boat?
The John Biscoe.
Yeah.
And quite nice and sheltered. And then they called us to dinner, and we're all in the mess room. And, of course, we haven't met everybody before, so there's a lot of strangers. We're strangers to each other. And slowly one became aware that there were fewer people in the mess, because by this time the ship was moving. And then you realised why. And so very courteously you said, oh, excuse me, please. And you got up gently and walked to the, then you sprinted like mad to the toilets. And then from then on, every day I was sick. In those days, we had to holy stone the decks as well, because they're wooden decking, and so you had these balls of lime on poles and scrub them. And I'd be doing that, and then suddenly be sick. So by the time we got to Monte, we spent about 4 days there, then another few days down to Hope Bay. And by the time I got off the ship, I was eating well on base. But a week after landing, Neil Orr, the doctor, he weighed us all, and I was a stone and a quarter light still then. I was down to about 8 1/4 stone after eating for a week.
Did he have any doubts about what you were doing if you were so poorly on the way down?
No.
Didn't throw you at all?
No. Because I knew the Antarctic wasn't moving like the ship.
You actually went to Hope Bay first of all, didn't you?
Because, yes, because they couldn't. The boat was due to go to Rothera, where Rothera is now.
To establish Rothera.
To establish it, yes. But the ice was still not broken up. And so for the first month, or 6 weeks maybe, I was at Hope Bay. And that was good, because Hope Bay was the leading sledging base. Mm-hmm. And during the summer anyway, most of the surveyors go up there to use the ships and the helicopters from the Navy ships to do a summer survey of the islands, and that's what was going on then. So I was at Hope Bay, but for my first ever field trip, I went with Dick Harbour and Mike Smith across to Mount Bransfield, which was a key station in this network. And that was very good, actually, because we went across the bay rather than sledging all the way around over by Mount Taylor and Flora. We went across the bay, took the dogs up the ice bank, and then sledged to Mount Bransfield. And then we camped there, and we had about 2 weeks there. We were there for New Year's Day. That's right, so it probably was November the 1st. By the time we got down there, because of, say, a month down there, yep, so it would be November the 1st or so. And notorious for bad weather up there. So it was a very good introduction, because I was with two people that had already spent a year, with the dogs, the surveyor. Wonderful introduction.
How did you take to the dogs? Were you a doggy man anyway?
No, no.
So that was another new skill to acquire.
Yes, but they're lovely, really. They're soft. And I didn't have to drive the dogs at that time. That came later from Adelaide. But I was quite happy with them. But I had one experience on Bransfield where I did stop and think, why am I doing this? Am I doing it right or not? But it worked out well. And
what was? Tell me more about the experience, Alan.
I lost the tent.
You lost the tent?
Yes. It is bad weather up there. You're in the cloud very often, and in the cloud, you can't see any detail.
Oh, you didn't lose it in a storm?
Yes.
You did, all right.
Yes, yes, it was. I was on outside man, so I went out to feed the dogs, and having fed them, I then went to the toilet, and I'd lost the tent completely. Luckily, by then, I knew how you could make the dogs howl. So I worked my way upwind and howled, which I hoped would set the dogs off, like, ow, and off they go. And then I went downwind, and I picked up the sound of the dogs, so I could go back upwind to the dogs, and then I found the tent.
All right, so it hadn't blown away.
Oh, no, I had lost myself.
Right.
After feeding the dogs...
The tent had lost you, in fact.
Yes, that's right, yes. Yeah, so
that was a bit of a lesson, I would imagine.
It was sobering.
Yeah.
But I obviously didn't tell anybody about this. And then in the book of Dogs and Men,
yeah.
Kevin Walton asked us to write little bits if we'd got, and I wrote about that. And when Mike Smith learned that, he said, because I met him just after that had come out, he came to one of the Hope Bay reunions, and he said, I never knew that.
So that's quite a clever tactic of yours, and you picked that up quite quickly because you hadn't been there very long.
Well, it's survival, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So you did about a month at Hope Bay. And then
yes, I think it was probably 5-6 weeks.
Yeah, and then eventually got to Adelaide.
Yes, then at the end of that session, they decided we could move down, and so the ship went down via Lockroy and the other bases, Adelaide, on the way, Argentine Islands, on the way down, passing through the Argentine Islands, it picked up the dogs and four other people who had failed to get into Rothera the year before. So there's Frank Preston, Gordon McCallum. Frank was the surveyor, Gordon was the dogman, Alan Crouch, general assistant, and Frank Fitton, radio op. And so they came on from Wordy with the dogs, and we went down and... I met Frank up at Hope Bay because he'd gone up for the survey. That was the first time I met him. And off we went down, and eventually we spent a day trying to break the ice into Low Berth Fjord, but unsuccessful, and they'd already got this backup plan of putting the hut on the southern end of Adelaide.
That's quite an experienced team, wasn't it, considering you were a new boy?
Yes, but that's the normal procedure. They try and swap half the men each year. And I suppose, yes, instead of 3 and 3, we were 4 and 2. But it was very good because they were all good people, well knitted together, and Graham and I fitted in okay. So that was good.
I presume that you had to start building these huts, did you?
Yes.
From scratch?
Yes.
From the prefabricated bits?
Yes, that is very simple and straightforward. And they'd got Jim Shurtcliffe, who was a carpenter come odd job man, and John Cunningham, who was a carpenter shipbuilder, Howard Chapman, surveyor, Frank Preston. So they got all the skills they wanted, and they built 9 blocks of concrete, or 12 blocks of concrete, cement fondue so that they could use seawater, and then put the floor. And then somebody had the brilliant idea that instead of building and then putting the stove in, it was one of these agar cookers, we'd put the agar stove on the floor before we put the walls up. It was much easier. And then we built the walls, put the roof on, and as soon as the roof was on, the ship went. And that left the 6 of us to finish the hut and establish ourselves. So we did.
What was it like, the hut? Basic?
Oh, very basic. The floor was about a 3/4 inch wood, one sheet of ash, roofing felt, and 3/4 inch of wood. So in the winter, when it got cold, if you spilled water on the floor, it froze. Mm. And we used to sit on the backs of the chairs and have our feet here because it was cold on the floor. But in the top bunks, you didn't need blankets. It was hot. But it was very good. We had
Did anybody ever make any attempt to try and remedy that problem? Because every fit I talk to, it's the same old story. Your feet were freezing, your head was hot. Now, did nobody ever think of trying to find a way of inverting that by using a fan or something?
No.
No?
No, you just...
Just live with it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it was... It's a good question, actually, but no... We only, out of each 12 months, we only spent less than 6 months in that basin. Mm. So we were out sledging for 6 months. And so it was luxury when we came back to it after living in the tent. Mm.
You had your own little space, I presume? Your own.
Yes, we had the layout in the hut. There was an entrance hall. And at the end of that, the design was a toilet. But we changed that. We used that area as a dark room for photographic, and we had a little part of the entrance hall curtained off for a toilet, and then the main room was with the stove and a table and 6 bunks around it and a window in the one wall. So it was basic but adequate.
Okay.
And the loft we used as a food store, a sledge workshop. And at the end of that, we made a survey office as well.
Well, did you get stuck into surveying quite quickly once the hut was up? Were you off and away?
Well, I was very lucky there because Frank Preston had tried to get into the Rotherham Point the year before and failed, but he'd had the whole year at Wordy, and part during that year, he'd managed to work up the survey plan for our combined period. And the main plan was to link the survey that had already been done at Stonington and at Horseshoe and to the north of Adelaide. So we got to link this up. And so he'd got the photographs, he'd got some maps, and he'd planned a triangulation and trilateration scheme to do that. So our main job, once the ship left, was to finish the hut and start laying bases so that we could do the reconnaissance in the spring.
And you had two teams doing that, right? Two dog teams?
No, we had four dog teams. Each of the four, Alan, Gordon, Frank, and Frank Fitton, Alan Crouch, Gordon McCallum, and Frank Preston, yeah. All four had a team. But we worked in two groups of three. The main reason being in unknown country, if there's three of you, it's easier to pull the third one out of the crevasse once he's dropped in it.
So you were leaving nobody behind a base?
No.
The base was empty when you were on the field?
Yes, yeah, because all the dogs were with us anyway. We had about 60 dogs.
Right.
So, and so, you quickly... So
the hut will be locked up for 6 months?
No, at intervals.
You come back occasionally?
Yes, okay. Yes. Right. I think my longest sledging trip was about 3 months. So you'd go out, come back, and Graham... It tended to be Graham Dewar, the geologist, with Frank Fitton. Who went with him? Alan Crouch. Mm. They went as one team, so that was the geology team. And the other was Frank, Gordon, and myself. I'm getting mixed up on this, so it's factually...
So one team was doing geology, one team was doing surveying.
Yes, that's right.
Okay,
purely for our reconnaissance work. Once we reconnoitred everywhere, we knew where we could go safely, and so from then on we went in, instead of two teams of three, we went in three teams of two. So I went with Gordon McCallum, Frank Fitton went with Graham Dewar, and Alan Crouch and Frank Preston went, which and meant we could get a lot more done. A
couple of questions in from that. One is, if there was nobody back at base, with whom were you in radio communication?
We used 68 sets. We'd each got a 68 set, and we'd communicate. Sometimes we could get through to each other. Other times, Tony Quinn at Stonington acted as our
radio control.
Radio point,
right,
yes.
Okay. And I think he has some fairly new kit, didn't he, for doing the surveying work?
Yes, telerometers. It was the first year for those. We'd had a week at Telerometer in London, learning how to use them, and that was quite good training because they would remove a valve and put in a dud valve, and they didn't tell us they'd done that. We had to find out what was wrong with it and correct it. So it was a very good course. And it transformed surveying. Up till those days, surveying was still carried out the same way as the Egyptians carried it out when they built the pyramids. It got a bit more sophisticated measurement of angles, but it was still basically the same. With the advent of the telerometer, you could transform your way of handling things. Instead of triangulation, you could use trilateration. And the very first telerometer job was done in Kenya, and they completed a 2.5-year project in 28 days. So
people like Frank Preston were aware then of the great advances that have been made?
Yes.
More than you, because you hadn't done it before?
Yes, yes.
Was he impressed?
Oh, yes, yes. They had their difficult sides as well.
What was the problem with them?
Batteries. You had to always carry two batteries. DOS, Director of Overseas Surveys, required each line that you measured with the telerometer to be measured in both directions, A to B and B to A, which is fine. But the first telerometers were only one function. They were either master or remote. So this meant to each survey point, you had to take two telerometers and you had to take two batches of batteries. And the other thing with them was the power control unit. And very often it was a vibrator. And sometimes it wouldn't work, so you had to kick it. And the instruction was, if it doesn't work, kick the power supply unit and it started vibrating.
Why was it vibrating?
It's part of the electronic technique producing the required signals. I can't give more details.
Right, so it was sending a signal to the other...
Yes.
The other meter.
Yeah.
Effectively, okay.
Yeah, and what was the other... The other thing was, it's very good also because it had a voice communication link. So with theodolites, all you've got is... Sometimes you've got a light at one end and a theodolite at the other, and you could devise some signalling with the lamps. With a telerometer, you had a telephone at each end. You could actually speak to each other. So it had a very useful function. But in the MRA-1, you took this phone out of a little compartment, but you could never get it back in again. And you had to get it in before you could pack it. So it was so frustrating. But
it does sound remarkably high-tech for 1961, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, it was, you're aware of GPS.
Well, I know about it, yes.
Right, well...
It was the first step, was it?
Telerometer was the first revolution in land surveying. The second was GPS.
That was 40 years later?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was both were good for me because eventually I ended up working with telerometer. And eventually I ended up having my own survey company working with GPS.
So you got quite a lot done in the remains of that summer, did you?
Yes, and the following year, the following season, we completed the complete survey. So that was wonderful for me. Poor old Frank had done the reconnaissance and had to go before we'd done very much. The following year, Dave Nash came in as the other surveyor, and he and I finished off the scheme, which meant that I then had 18 months of writing up at home, so poor old Dave, when he came home, he'd not got any of the project to write up. So I was very, very fortunate.
Yeah. You were surveying around Rotherhithe again.
Yes.
Was that because they were planning to build a hut there?
No, that was our link with the surveying area. We, because of the ship couldn't get in, we had to build a base at the southern end, but we had no sea ice link round Adelaide, so we had to go up the main Piedmont, down a place called Shambles Col, into what was then called Square Peninsula, and then we could reconnoitre that, but we still couldn't get on the sea ice. When we could get on the sea ice, we could complete all the reconnaissance and start the observations.
And were you tying this in at all to any aerial survey?
Yes, we were using aerial photography, and in fact some of the photographs were flown while we were there, using the otters. So we actually had to fly some of the photography. And in fact it was very good. All our points, we had a photo identify on these photographs, which then, back at DOS, they could set out the whole scheme.
You managed to get yourself down to Fossil Bluff, I think, at one point, didn't you?
Yes, purely as co-pilots. that was great, because Fossil Bluff was being built, so all the equipment was offloaded at Adelaide, and the aircraft flew down later in the summer, and the pilot had to have somebody travel with him, and so we all took it in turns to go with, it was Bob Bond, the name's gone, of the co-pilot. Yeah, so that was good. And also, the following year, the planes got down before the ships did. And so when the ship was getting close, went out in the plane to greet the ship, which is good.
And you were building some more huts at Adelaide. You were developing the base a bit more.
Yes, it became a building site almost. The first year we had this one hut, Stevenson House. And then the second year they built a musket garage, a diesel shed, and another base hut. So the base hut, they increased the number of people on base from 6 to 11. So they had a static base and the field base. And instead of a diesel shed made out of packing cases on our shed, we had a proper diesel engine. When we had our hut, you've got to have the power running so the radio would work, but the generator interrupted with the radio signal.
Interfered with it?
Yes. So eventually you had to have a foot generator, switch the power off, have a foot generator.
You're
while
cycling
the radio.
With your feet now.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I was on base once and I had to cycle and key. And as soon as you're transmitting, the resistance builds up on the cycle. So it's quite interesting.
You were able to actually pedal and operate the...
The Morse key, yes.
At the same time?
Yes, yes.
Not many people manage to do that.
It's like rubbing your head and your stomach.
Putting your stomach, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So did you have some escapades in the field when you were doing your survey work? Apart from losing your tent or not finding it, rather.
Yes, not finding the tent, was it? Yes, there were three that I can recall. One of them should have been scary, but wasn't. But the other two, the one I've already mentioned about losing the tent, or I say losing the tent, but you're quite right, we didn't lose the tent. The tent lost me. Mm. I lost myself. Mm. But it sounds much better saying I lost the tent than I lost myself. So that was the one. The scariest, I suppose, was when we were going up Mount Ditty. This would be the first year. There was Gordon McCallum leading, myself carrying the survey kit, and Alan Crouch at the end. We went up, we did the observations, and we were coming down, and Alan went through a crevasse, and it was on a steep slope. Mm. And I can still see in my mind, I've still got the image of Alan probing and disappearing. And we all came off, and we were all sliding. And fortunately, towards the crevasse. And fortunately, Alan came to a bridge in the crevasse, a snow bridge. And so we stopped. So I was then able to get my ice axe in because I hadn't been able to get it in. Gordon came down and established voice contact, established that Alan was completely sure he could untie. And then Gordon and I went down and we crossed the crevasse in a different spot, came up from below and got Alan out that way.
It's a clever plan, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, but it was so hot, I'd taken my gloves off, so I lost all the skin on my knuckles. But that was, it's funny, things go through your mind as you're sliding down and you realise you've done everything you can, but you're still sliding. So that was one.
Did it shake you up at all?
No.
And did you adjust your practice in the light of the near miss?
No, because we'd done everything we could do.
And you were roped together in
the Yes, everything was in order. And we were lucky with the Stonebridge.
Okay.
The other one, this was on the summer survey the following year. And HMS Protector comes down and the helicopters lift us onto different islands. And I was being landed onto Gabriant Island. And they were winching me down onto the top. And then the helicopter lost its lift. And the next thing I knew, I was lying on my back on the top. And the helicopter was here.
On my chest.
And then it shot up, got its lift, and I'm thinking, shall I unhook? And luckily I didn't, because it was hot out. And if I had unhooked, I'd have had a quick descent to the base. It's about 400 feet, I think. And then he landed us. But when the helicopter got back to the protector, there's a rating runs in each side with chocks to chock the wheels. And this one ran in, then he ran straight out again because the undercarriage had been smashed on the rock. So I was very lucky. But that should have been scary, but it wasn't.
And that was simply because, for some reason, that...
Well, because of the shape of the island, it's quite a severe drop on the one side, and he was hovering over this, and obviously a gust of wind had come and stopped, and he just...
The air pressure had gone.
Yeah.
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 And you didn't lie awake at night sweating at all after that? And...
No. No. Not at all.
Young Fids seem to have a sense of immortality, it seems to me. Is that right?
Either that or we don't have an imagination. Because when we went down, I mentioned Shambles Glacier. Mm. Down there, they did lose people one year. And sometimes, you could see, you'd be on the crevasse and the whole dog team and sledge were on the crevasse. But we were lucky. So you have I think you just don't think too deeply about it.
Do you have any other unusual moments?
I think moments of humour more than anything else. There are a couple I can think of. The one was my first curry, with a base of six.
Your first curry?
Curry, yes.
Oh, I want to hear this. Go on.
Well, it shows the expertise that I developed in my cooking skills.
Had you any previous cooking skills before you went?
Only camping, that sort of thing. But I never. My first curry was eaten on base. It was the first time I'd ever had a curry. And by this time, I'm 26, I suppose. but I was on our base... The six of us, and so we had a 12-day rota. 2 days on one job, 2 days on another, and so on. And 2 days on cook. I was on my cook, and I thought, I'll do a curry. And everybody was ready, waiting. The rice was taking a long time to cook. I hadn't realised that you had to boil the rice before you fry it. So I had a quick learning curve then. So that was one. Another one is a deception. I think this was on my way out No, more likely it was on the way down. We were loading kit onto the launch to be taken back to the ship from base. And I was, and you stand on the edge and you swing back, swing it and loose it. And I'm just getting to this position. And they said, no, we can't take that. And stupidly, I held on to it. So I learnt about momentum.
Laurel and Hardy moment, wasn't it?
Yes, and I went in the sea. So, but what else? No, that's probably all. We welded together, the six of us, very well. It was a good base. In fact, five of us, we're still in touch. The sixth one, we've lost. But when I go back, I'm staying up tomorrow, and I shall go back Monday. I'm going to call in at Skelmersdale Town Hall and try and locate this Alan Crouch, who has disappeared. He used to work for Skelmersdale City Council.
Right.
So I'll try and see what
Good luck in Skelmersdale.
Why?
Don't leave your car unattended.
Really? Okay.
Well, it's probably improved now, but when I was working in Liverpool in the early 80s, it was somewhere you didn't go in the dark.
Really?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
The Fuchs Ice Piedmont was something that you were concerned about as well, wasn't it? I think you were... Well, they're not trying to find a way of landing aeroplanes, though. Have I got that right?
That's where they did land the aircraft. in fact, they... Bob Bond and Abe Lincoln was the other pilot with him, but Bob Bond was a fantastic pilot because flying the stuff to the bluff, he'd take as much as he could on the aircraft. And when it was a strong wind, he'd almost do a vertical takeoff. He'd rev up and off you'd go. It was interesting for when he's coming back sledging, though, because it was convex. So you couldn't see the edge. You couldn't see base. There was no island off base. So you just had to have your direction right. And if you didn't, you ran into crevasses. And then you got a 100-foot cliff. In fact, once, one of the teams, a dog got off and he went over the cliff. But amazingly, he walked back along the ice. That's the only thing I can think on the Piedmont.
Yeah, okay. And again, in Ice and Men, it suggests that actually you divided, when you're doing the basic survey work, you worked very much on the east coast, linking up to Horseshoe Island, and Frank Preston worked northwards. Is that how you remember it?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Yes. Yes, when we split into our two teams, I'd forgotten that, to be honest. Yes, so Gordon and I worked on Loughborough Fjord, so we went to Webb Island, Wyatt Island, Day Island, we visited all these, went up to the gullet, and in fact, when we were going to observe the telerometer links on that from HMS Protector, they tried to land two of us, Dave Hansel and myself, on Day Island, but they couldn't, and so Captain Graham at the time, he actually brought HMS Protector right up to the gullet, and a couple of seamen came with us, and we chipped a platform on Day Island so as we could pitch the tent, and then off it went and left us there. So that
door-to-door service.
Yes, and it was lovely working in that area, Pinheiro Island as well. The very first time we went down to Rothera Point by sledge, this was in the summer, the first year that we were there, before there was no sea ice, and in fact it was deathly quiet, and you could hear the whales blowing and you could see the whales. It was absolutely wonderful. Another time I was on an island in the summer survey, very small island off Cape Alexander, no, off Alexandra Point, and two whales passed us, and the island was only as big as your room here, and we were looking down on the whales. So that was very good. Yes, so Gordon and I covered that area, Pinheiro Island. I think we had the best. And Frank did the northern end, Mount Villa.
When it came to go, Alan, what were your feelings?
Sad. Sad. If anything had happened, and the ship hadn't come in, I had to say I'd have been quite happy. And then I left the ship at Montevideo with John Killingbeck, and we spent 3 months travelling through South America. So that was another adventure as well. That was enjoyable.
You wound up in northern Chile in the copper mining area.
Yes, we went from Montevideo down to Bahia Blanca, and then we crossed Argentina, and we went through the Lake District, the Chilean Lake District, and then travelled up Chile. And we stopped at Santiago and stayed with the Chilean base leader that was base leader at Deception when John was base leader on the British base.
John Killingbeck.
John Killingbeck, yes. So we stayed with him, and here he was in the Air Force, and he arranged for us to have a military flight up to Antofagasta. And then John and I went to the copper mine office and asked if there's any chance of visiting Chuquicamata copper mine. And they said yes, and so we got there. Wonderful.
Did you watch the rescue of the Chilean miners the other week on television?
I haven't got television,
yeah,
so I didn't. But
you heard about it.
I heard about it. I was following it closely on the radio. Wonderful achievement, that. Mm.
Did you ever try to go back again?
Yes and no. I had the opportunity, and in hindsight, I should have taken it. Bill Sloman asked me if I'd go as the British observer on an Argentinian base. And I was just finishing my 18-month writing up at DOS, and I'd got in my mind I ought to try and continue my engineering side of things. And so I opted no. If I had said yes, I don't know what would have happened. I may have stayed all my time working with FIDS on there. As it was, I joined a company that built masts, television masts and things, and eventually I ended up working for Telurometer, and I wouldn't have missed that for anything. So there's pluses and minuses.
Have you been back in more recent years?
I went back 2005 on the trip that Neil Marsden organised, Marguerite Bay 2005. And that was tremendous, except the only base we couldn't land at was Base T, where there was much less ice around, and there was a very heavy swell, so we couldn't land. And that was sad, because I'd have loved to gone back to those huts. Everywhere else we went, it was amazing at Rothera, where the winter we had our base photograph taken there, the six of us with our two tents. And now there's the ship, the Polar Star, berthed alongside, and they laid on a buffet for 120 visitors. It was incredible. And aircraft hangar for three or four aircraft, the equipment store that looked like a Lily White's sports equipment shop in London. It was a wonderful experience. So yes, I have been back.
It's been lovely. Thank you, Alan, so much for sharing.
Is that enough to give you information?
If you want more, you want to say.
I think we've covered everything. It was a wonderful period in my life, and I don't think that I changed during that, but it gave me tremendous experience, which has always been something to look back to.
What from your Antarctic years do you think you employed in your life since? What?
Probably everything. Getting on with people, because one was aware that you did have to make some allowances at times. If you you could become critical of the way the other guy spread the butter on the biscuits. After you've been with somebody for 3 months, it's careful, but you have to be careful, and you realise that, and we all seem to get on okay.
So your tolerance levels were improved, were they?
I don't know that they were improved, but certainly it's an experience that carried through to later life. And the other thing, I think one of the main things, is there are two attitudes in life. When there's a problem, there's the group of people that say, oh dear, what are we going to do now? And there's a group of people who say, ah, how are we going to get round this? And the latter is always the course you have to take. I think that's one of the best things, because as soon as the ship's gone, you're on your own, and you've got to do everything. And we were lucky. We had a good job to do.
Great. That's marvellous. Thank you, Alan.
Right.
You.